trying to keep his suddenly murderous thoughts out of his voice. No, the old woman hadn't done anything so obvious as calling security. Not her.
"I was just about to call you, actually," he added, as the Bothans fanned out across the shop. "We only just discovered it ourselves."
"You have a list of inventory and stock?"
Preuskin called back over his shoulder.
"I'll get it for you,"
Cliff volunteered, heading off toward the computer. One of the Bothans had paused beside the Prompus cage.
"Proprietor," he called, "what are these cylinders?"
He reached down.
Please be careful with those,"
Navit said quickly, hurrying to his side, mind furiously casting about for something that would sound reasonable.
"They're hormonal drip capsules for our baby Martrins."
"What sort of hormones are required?"
the Bothan asked.
Newborn Markrids need a particular combination of solar spectrum, atmospheric conditions, and diet,"
Cliff put in, picking up on Navit's cue and running with it as only Cliff could do.
"You can almost never get the right mixture off their own world, so you use a hormonal drip."
"That's them over there,"
Navit added, pointing to the cage with the tiny lizards.
"We fasten the cylinders onto their backs with custom-designed harnesses."
"I see,"
the Bothan said, peering at them.
"When will this need to be done?"
"This morning, actually," Cliff said. "Sorry, but you'll have to look around on your own for a while, Investigator Preuskin, if you don't mind."
Of course," Preuskin said. "Please carry on."
Navit stepped over to one of the overturned tables, hiding a grimly satisfied smile as he set it upright again. So much for the old woman's attempt at subtlety. Clearly, he and Cliff could out-subtle her any day of the week. Not only did they now have reason to postpone long official questions, not only had they soothed any possible suspicion by offering the investigators the run of the place, but they would even be setting up the final phase of their plan right under the collective nose-fur of Bothan officialdom. Of course, they hadn't planned to institute that particular phase for a couple of days yet, but you couldn't have everything. Setting up the restraint grid, ignoring the quietly bustling Bothans wandering around looking for clues, they set to work. They had finished fitting 97 of the Mokrins with harnesses and cylinders, with about 20 more to go, when Navit first became aware of the new odor wafting through the shop. He looked up at Cliff, engrossed in attaching one of the cylinders onto the back of the tiny lizard standing in rigid immobility on the restraint grid, then let his gaze shift around the shop. The four original Bothan investigators had long since left, replaced by a group of three techs busily pulling handprints and chemical samples from the various counters and cages. None of them seemed to have noticed the smell. Cliff looked up, caught the expression on Navit's face.
"Trouble?" he murmured.
Navit wrinkled his nose. Cliff frowned, sniffing the air. And suddenly his eyes widened. "Smoke." Navit nodded fractionally, his eyes darting again around the shop. Nothing was visible, no flames and no smoke, but the smell was definitely getting stronger.
"She wouldn't," Cliff hissed.
"Would she?"
"We'd better assume she would,"
Navit said.
"Take some Mokrins we've finished and get them over to the Tapcalf."
"Now?" Cliff glanced at the bright sunshine outside the window.
"Navit, there's a full staff at work there right now."
"Then you'd better come up with a really dandy diversion to get them out of the way,"
Navit shot back. "If they lost the Mokrins, this whole thing would have been for nothing."
"Pick up Penson and Horvick. We're in full emergency mode here."
Cliff nodded grimly. "Got it," he said. Setting his tools aside, he started putting the last few Mokrins back into the cage. And suddenly, one of the Bothans let out a squawk.
"Fire!"
he bleated.
"The building is on fire! Morvivial! Call the extinguishers! Hurry!"
"Fire?"
Navit asked, looking around in feigned bewilderment.
Where? I don't see any fire.
Foolish human,
the Bothan snapped.
Can't you smell the smoke? Hurry, leave everything and go.
Navid shot a glare at Cliff. So that was the old woman's plan. She couldn't figure out what in the shop their scheme needed, so she was going to force them to leave without any of it.
But my stock is very valuable,
he protested.
As valuable as your life?
The Bothan, ignoring his own advice, was moving rapidly around the outer edge of the shop, hands brushing along the walls.
Go! Get out!
What are you doing? Cliff asked.
You are right. There is no flame yet,
the Bothan explained.
The fire must therefore be inside the walls.
The extinguishers are coming,
one of the other Bothans reported anxiously, waving his comlink.
But they will not be here for a few more minutes.
Understood,
the first said, pausing at the power coupling box. Abruptly, his fur flattened, and he pulled a knife from his belt.
Perhaps we can help prepare the way.
Wait a minute!
Navid barked, jumping forward. The Bothan had dug the knife between wall panels directly over their hidden compartment.
What the fracas are you doing?
The fire smells of wiring,
the Bothan explained breathlessly.
Here at the power coupling is the likely place for us to be. If we can expose it and bring fire preventers to bear...
He broke off, staggering as the prying knife unexpectedly shattered through the relatively thin false front of the storage compartment. He caught his balance, gaping at the Night Stinger sniper blaster now visible inside.
Proprietor Navid!
He exclaimed.
What is this weapon you...
He fell to the floor, question unfinished, as Navid shot him in the back. The second Bothan got out just a squeak before Navit's second shot dropped him. The third was fumbling frantically for both comlink and blaster when Cliff's shot took him out.
Well, that's torn it,
Cliff snarled, glaring at Navid.
What in the Empire would... She's expecting us to be properly professional about this,
Navid ground out.
Once professionals never start shooting unless they have to. So fine, we've just gone unprofessional. That ought to take her by surprise.
No, terrific, Cliff said. A brilliantly unorthodox strategy. Now what do we do?
We take it down, that's what.
Navid snarled back, thrusting his blaster back into his tunic and stepping over the body to pull the Night Stinger from its hiding place.
Rouse Penson und Horvick and get your tails out to the ship and into space. You've got 2 hours, maybe less, to get aboard the Predominance and into position.
Night Stinger in hand, he turned back to find a stunned look on Cliff's face.
Navid, we can't do it now, he protested. The attack force won't be ready for another 3 days.
You want to try to dodge our lady friends that long?
Navid snapped, dropping the Night Stinger onto the table and starting to scoop the rest of the Mokrans into their cage.
You can see her plan. She's trying to maneuver the police or extinguishers or Vader knows who else in a uniform into running interference against us for her. We have to move now, and she's not expecting it.
But the attack force...
Stop worrying about the attack force,
Navid cut him off.
They'll be ready, all right? Or we'll get that way blasted quick. You have your orders.
All right, Cliff said, sliding his own weapon away. I'll leave you the landspeeder. I can lift another one for the 3 of us. Anything else you need?
Nothing I can't get myself,
Navid told him shortly.
Go on! The chrono's counting!
Right. Good luck.
He left. Navid finished getting the Mokrans into their cage, then gathered up the rest of the cylinders and slid them back into the cage's false bottom. Yes, the old woman had forced his hand, and that sudden drastic change in plans was going to cost them dearly. But if she thought she'd won, she was mistaken. He only wished he could be around to see her when she realized that.
I I'm sure you understand, Admiral,
Paloma Dasima said, obviously picking her words very carefully.
How unprecedented this step would be for our people. We have never before had what might be considered close relations with the Empire.
Seated a quarter of the way around the table, Deesra suppressed a cynical smile. Paloma Dasima, one of the proud and exalted 11 of the Mistral, might well think herself subtle, even clever in the ways of politics and political sparring. But to him, she was as patently transparent as only a rank amateur could be. If this was the best the Mistral could do, he would have them eating out of his hand before the day was over. Or rather, eating out of Grand Admiral Thrawn's hand.
I understand the conflicts we've had in the past, Thrawn said gravely. However, as I've pointed out to you, and to Caroli Doolin before you, he added, nodding politely to the younger woman at Dasima's side. The Empire under my leadership will bear little resemblance to that of the late Emperor Palpatine.
I understand that, the older woman said.
Her face wasn't giving anything away. Her hands, though, more than made up for it.
I only bring it up to remind you that we would need more than just your word as guarantee. Are you questioning the word of Grand Admiral Thrawn?
Deesra asked, letting just a hint of edge into his voice. The gambit worked. Dasima was instantly on the defensive.
Not at all, she assured him, too quickly. It's merely that...
She was saved by a signal from the conference room intercom.
Admiral Thrawn, this is Captain Dorja,
the familiar voice said. Seated at Thrawn's side, Tierce touched the switch.
This is Major Tierce, Captain,
he said.
The Admiral is listening.
Forgive the interruption, sir, but you asked to be informed immediately if any unscheduled ships approach the base. They've just received a transmission from the Imperial Star Destroyer Tyrannic, requesting emergency assistance.
Deesra threw a startled look at Tierce. The Tyrannic was one of the three ships lurking behind their cloaking shields off Balthawee. Or at least it was supposed to be there.
Did they specify the nature of their emergency?
Thrawn asked.
Coming through now, sir. They say they've come under attack by a sizable New Republic assault force and have been severely damaged. They say the force is right behind them and that they need shelter. General Hestiv is requesting instructions.
Deesra felt a tight smile crease his lips. No. Of course it wasn't the real Tyrannic out there. Tierce's hunch had been right. Coruscant had indeed launched a mad attempt to steal a copy of the Ka'amas document. And not only was the trap ready and waiting, they even had one of the Mistral's 11 here to watch that pitiful attempt turned into a humiliating defeat. The real Thrawn couldn't have arranged things better.
Instruct General Hestiv to let the incoming Star Destroyer pass the outer perimeter,
Thrawn told Dorja.
He's then to put all defenses on battle readiness and prepare for enemy attack.
Yes, sir.
And then, Captain, Thrawn added, you will similarly prepare the Relentless for combat. Track the incoming Star Destroyer as it approaches and plot its course, then bring us to stand directly between it and the base. At that point, you will order General Hestiv to bring full inner defenses to bear on it.
Yes, sir,
Dorja said, sounding slightly puzzled, but nevertheless unquestioning.
Will you be coming to the bridge?
Of course, Captain.
Thrawn stood up, favoring Dasima with a slight smile, as he gestured her toward the conference room door.
In fact, I believe we all will.
The sudden noise snapped Ghent out of his doze and sent him jerking upright in his chair. He looked around the work area wildly, saw he was still alone. Only then did his sleep-fogged mind realize the sound was some kind of alarm. He looked around the room again, searching for the source of the trouble. There was nothing he could see. Obviously, it must be elsewhere in the station, A moment's search in the climate-controlled section of the board, and he found the cutoff switch. The sound faded away into an unpleasant ringing in his ears. For another moment, he looked at the board, wondering if it would be worth trying to tap into the main comm system and find out what was going on. Probably not. Whatever it was, it probably didn't have anything to do with him. He frowned suddenly. The board in front of him seemed to be flickering. Flickering? The frown vanished into relieved understanding. Of course. He was getting reflections of light coming in through the viewport in the living area behind him. Getting to his feet, wincing as his knees informed him he'd been sitting in one place too long again, he hobbled in through the open door and peered out the viewport. The source of the flickering light was instantly apparent. An awesome display of multiple turbolaser and proton torpedo blasts coming from the distance near the base's outer defense perimeter. And framed in the center of all that flashing firepower, bearing inexorably straight down on him, was the huge bulk of an Imperial Star Destroyer. Kent caught his breath, staring at the incoming ship. Suddenly, all of Pellion's and Hestiv's talk about danger and threats, tucked snugly away in the back of his mind for the past few days, came rushing to the forefront again. That Star Destroyer was coming for him. He was sure of it. Run! The thought flashed into his mind. Run out of here, down the long tunnel into the main base. Find General Hestiv, or that TIE pilot who brought him in here from the Chimera, or just find somewhere to hide. But no. Hestiv had warned him about spies inside the main base. If he went there, one of them would surely get him. And besides, he remembered suddenly, he couldn't go anywhere. He triple-sealed the single-access door, passwording it with a layer of computer locks that would take any enemy hours to slice through. Even he, who'd set the blocks up in the first place, would probably need half an hour to undo them. And half an hour would be too late. Far too late. For another minute, he watched the incoming ship, wondering distantly what they would do to him. Then, with a sigh, he turned away. He was trapped here. They were coming for him, and there was nothing he could do. Returning to the work area, this time closing the door behind him, he went back to his seat. The Wickstrom K-220s had finally finished the complex analysis he'd set for them to do before all this happened. Keying the results over to the Master Line 70, pushing the events outside once again into the back of his mind, he got back to work. It took Navit half an hour to locate and purchase the pressurized tank of flammable fluid he needed, and another 15 minutes to fit it with a sprayer hose. 45 minutes gone, during which time the alarm over the dead Bothans in the pet shop had probably spread to every corner of the city. But that was all right. The ugly, furry aliens couldn't stop him now. And the more time it took him to get ready here on the planetary surface, the more time Cliff and Penson and Horvick would have to wheedle their way aboard that Ashori ship overhead. They would die there, of course. They knew that. But then he would soon be dying down here, too. What was important was that before they died, they would complete their task. The streets around the Hodin Tapcalf, so quiet and deserted in the late night, were buzzing with activity here in the early afternoon. With the fluid tank pressed into the seat beside him, wedged at an awkward angle against the low roof, Navit drove slowly down the deserted alleys along the sides and back of the Tapcalf, systematically spraying a thick layer of the liquid along the lower walls and the ground around them. The front wall, facing as it did onto a busy street, was too public for him to do the same there without arousing instant suspicion. But he had other plans for that area anyway. Returning to the back alley, again making sure he was unobserved, he fired a blaster bolt into the fluid as he drove past the Tapcalf. He took his time circling through the alleyways until he came around again onto the main street. with the result that by the time he let the land speeder coast to a stop across from the tap calf, the fire he'd started was blazing furiously away along the outer walls. Pedestrians were running frantically to and fro, waving and yelling as they either fled from the flames or formed themselves into ghoulish knots at a safe distance to watch. And as Nabbit retrieved the Night Stinger from the back seat, the Tapcalf's front doors swung open, and a crowd of equally hysterical customers and waitstaff began streaming out through the smoke. Checking the Night Stinger's indicator, confirming that he still had 3 shots left, Nabbit settled down to wait. He didn't have to wait very long. The stream of refugees from the Tapcalf had barely begun to dwindle when a white extinguisher speeder truck came roaring around the corner and braked to a hard stop at one corner of the building. Through the side window, Nabbit could see the driver gesticulating as his partners scrambled out and started climbing the outside ladder toward the pressure turret on top. He never made it. Resting the muzzle of the Night Stinger on the seat back for stability, Nabbit shot him down. His second invisible blast took out the driver. His third and last blew off the speeder truck's filler tube cap, sending the fire suppressant gushing onto the street to flow uselessly away from the flames. He lowered the now empty blaster onto the floor, giving the crowd around him a quick look. But no one was paying the slightest attention to the human sitting alone in his land speeder. Every eye was locked solidly on the blazing building, with probably only an occasional brief thought turned to the puzzle of the 2 Bothan extinguishers who had suddenly and inexplicably collapsed. The flow of customers from the Tapcalf had stopped now. Nabbit gave it 30 more seconds just to make sure everyone was out. Then, drawing his blaster and laying it ready on the seat beside him, he started the land speeder and eased his way through the crowd toward the Tapcalf's front doors. He was through the main part of the crowd before anyone even seemed to notice what he was doing. Someone shouted, and a Bothan wearing the green-yellow police sash jumped out in front of him, waving his arms violently. Snatching up his blaster, Nabbit shot him, veered around the body, and leaned hard on the accelerator. Someone behind him was screaming now. Bracing himself, Nabbit increased his speed. He hit the Tapcalf doors with bone-jarring force, smashing them into shards as the land speeder ground to a halt right in the middle of the destruction. He was out before the debris finished bouncing off the vehicle's roof. Snatching the cage of Mokrins from the back and sprinting through the smoke and heat toward the door to the basement and the sub-basement beyond it. He was halfway down the first flight of stairs when, behind him, he heard the explosion as the heat set off the remaining fluid in the pressurized tank he'd left in the land speeder. And with the front of the Tapcalf now as engulfed in flames as the rest of the building, he was truly and irrevocably cut off from the outside world. No one in the universe could stop him now. There was just a hint of smoke in the sub-basement. Nothing serious, just a foreshadowing of what would inevitably come. Their equipment was just where they'd left it, but he took a minute first to run a quick check on the fusion disintegrator. It was a good thing he had. The old woman had been here again, gimmicking the device to overload and burn out the main control coil when it was first started. Grinning humorlessly to himself, Nabbit ungimmicked it, then spent a few more precious minutes reconfiguring the focus to extend the disintegration beam a few centimeters out from the canister mouth. Finally, he was ready. Strapping the Mokrin cage awkwardly to his back, he dropped into the hole he and Cliff had dug and turned on the disintegrator. The beam cut through the soil beneath his feet like a blaster bolt through snow, sending a gale of microscopic dust flowing up past his face. Fleetingly, he wished he'd thought to bring a filter mask with him. Too late now. Squinting against the eye-burning wind, he kept going, wondering what the Bothans were doing about the myriad of alarms he was undoubtedly setting off. Running around uselessly, no doubt, particularly once they saw that the source of the intrusion was totally inaccessible to them. And some of them would probably sit back and relax, smugly secure in the knowledge that losing the power conduit he was digging toward wouldn't affect their precious shield in the slightest. Possibly they were even having a hearty laugh at the foolish Imperial agent who thought he could shut them down so easily. Or who perhaps thought he could crawl through a 10-centimeter diameter conduit. They wouldn't be laughing that way for long. It took only a few minutes to dig the rest of the way down to the power conduit. The conduit shell was heavily armored, and it took nearly 10 minutes more for the disintegrator beam to eat its way through. The power cables themselves flash-burned almost instantly once that happened, of course. They were, after all, only normal power cables, not designed to withstand anything more strenuous than high-power electrical current. He kept at it until he had carved himself a decently sized hole in the outer shell, then shut off the disintegrator and switched on the coolant pack built into the bottom. A few minutes of systematic spraying, and the area was once again cool enough to touch. He shut off the coolant and sat down by the opening. And in the sudden silence, he heard a quiet new sound. The beep of a comlink coming from the disintegrator. He frowned, checking the device. There it was, wedged into the refill intake for the coolant pack. Smiling tightly, he pulled it out and turned it on. "Hello there," he said. "Everything running to your satisfaction?"
"What in the name of Alderaan dust are you doing?"
the old woman's voice demanded. He smiled more broadly, wedging the comlink into his collar and opening the Mokran cage's false bottom.
"What's the matter?"
he asked, pulling out a small tube of food paste.
"I didn't actually take you by surprise or anything, did I? That was a cute trick with the smoke at the pet shop, by the way. I take it you planted that before you left this morning?"
"Yes. I figured you had all your good stuff upstairs with you, or else had it hidden behind walls or ceilings."
"So you planted a delayed-action smoke bomb, so the extinguishers would come in and open up the walls for you,"
Navid said, opening the cage and extracting one of the tiny lizards.
"Very clever.
Look, you haven't got time for this chit-chat. In case you haven't noticed, that building is burning like a torch over your head."
"Oh, I know,"
Navid said. Holding the lizard with one hand, he dabbed a drop of the food paste onto the end of its nose and set it down into the hole he'd cut, pointing it in the direction of the generator building. A touch on one end of the cylindrical bomb activated it, setting it to explode when the lizard reached the blockage where the conduit passed through the reinforced wall, and set its individual power cables splitting off into a dozen different directions. He released his grip, and the Mokran scrambled away through the narrow space between the power cables and the conduit shell, following the scent it was too stupid to realize was attached to its own nose.
"What do you mean, you know? Unless you do something real clever, real fast, you're going to die in there. You know that, too?"
"We all have to die sometime,"
Navid reminded her, dabbing the nose of another Mokran and sending it to follow the first. It had barely vanished down the conduit when the faint sound of a small explosion echoed down the tube. There was nothing wrong with the old woman's ears.
"What was that?"
"The death of Bothui," Navid told her, dabbing another Mokran and releasing it as a second explosion sounded.
Now that the fumes of disintegrated dirt were dissipating, he could tell that the odor of smoke was getting stronger.
"You know, we never did figure out what your name was,"
he added, pulling out another Mokran and wondering uneasily just how fast the fire above him was spreading. If either the flame or smoke got to him before the Mokrans and their tiny bombs were able to blow a hole through the group of unarmored power cables just inside the generator building, he could still lose.
"So what is it?"
"What, my name? You tell me yours, and I'll tell you mine."
"Sorry," he said, releasing the Mokran. "My name might still be of use to someone down the line, even after I myself no longer am."
There was another explosion, and then, to his relief and immense satisfaction, a breath of cool air drifted up into his face. The power cables had been blown apart inside the wall, and the generator building had been laid open to him.
Look, Imperial.
Conversation's over.
Navid cut her off. Enjoy the fire. He clicked off the comlink and tossed it aside. Then he tipped the cage over, allowing the rest of the Mokrans to swarm free. For a moment they swirled around his lap and feet, getting their balance and sniffing the air. Then, in a sudden concerted rush, they clawed their way past each other to disappear down the conduit. Drawn now not by food paste on their noses, but by the tiny spots of liquid nutrient he and Cliff had so carefully positioned 3 days ago as they'd sprayed for metal mites. And there remained just one final task for him to perform. Reaching into the bottom of the cage, he pulled out the last item there. The remote arming signaler to activate the rest of the cylinders now being carried toward their rendezvous with Destiny. A few more seconds, and his self-guided bombs would be spilling out into the generator building around the startled Bothan's feet, skittering across the polished floor straight to the key points of the whole installation. Along the conduit, he could hear the faint sounds of explosions now as the Mokrans reached their targets and the cylinder's proximity fuses began to ignite. A few more seconds, a minute at the most, and the section of the planetary shield protecting Dreb's Starn would collapse. The death of Bothui had begun, and with it, the death of the New Republic. His only regret was that he wouldn't be around to see it all happen. Overhead, the sounds of flames could be heard now, a crackling noise mixing with the fainter staccato of the bombs still going off in the distance. Smiling up at the ceiling, Navit leaned his back against the dirt wall and waited for the end. The discussions aboard the Predominance had just entered their fourth round when the deck below them gave a sudden rumbling vibration, a sound and sensation that Leia had become all too familiar with over the years. Somewhere in the depths of the Ishori ship, a turbolaser cluster had just fired. The captain was on the intercom even before the rumble had died away.
"What is the firing?"
he snarled. The answer tumbled out in Ishori, too fast and too faint for Leia to follow.
"Oh, what is happening?"
Gaversum demanded.
"You agreed there would be no hostilities while..."
"It is not us,"
the captain snarled, diving for the door.
"Aliens have taken over one of our weapons clusters and are firing at the ground."
"What?"
Gaversum asked, blinking.
"But how?"
But the captain was already gone, taking the door guards with him.
"Counselor Organa Solo?"
Gaversum began, breaking off as another rumble rolled through the ship.
"Counselor, what is happening here?"
Leia shook her head.
"I don't..."
And suddenly, she jerked in her seat, inhaling sharply as a surge of fear and pain and death shot through her. On the planet below, voices were crying out in terror. And in that single, horrifying instant, she knew what had happened.
"The planetary shield's down!"
she snapped, getting out of her chair and rushing to the viewport. She reached it just in time to see a third massive turbolaser blast burn its way from the underside of the ship toward the surface. There was a flash of white as it sizzled through the atmosphere, and then the distortion cleared, leaving an angry black-tinged red glow behind. Dreb Starn, the Bothan capital, was on fire. She turned back, heading for the door.
"It's down, all right," she shouted to Gaversum as she ran past him. "At least over Dreb Starn."
"Where are you going?"
Gaversum called after her.
"To try to stop the shooting,"
Leia called back. Outside, a dozen armor-clad Ishori were charging down the corridor, blaster carbines at the ready. Pressed against the bulkheads, trying to stay out of the way, her two Nogri guards looked up at her.
"Counselor?"
"Come on,"
Leia told them, unhooking her lightsaber from her belt, stretching out to the Force for strength and wisdom. She joined in with the flow. Han hit the Falcon's cockpit at a full run, skidding to a halt just barely in front of the control board.
Where?
He barked, dropping into the pilot seat.
There,
Elego said tightly, pointing through the viewport at the dark ship lying in space not 2 kilometers away.
I don't know whose ship it is, but...
He broke off as another flash of red fire cut through the black of space on its way toward the planet below.
There! Did you see it?
Oh yeah, I saw it,
Han snarled, a hard jab of fear punching up under his heart as he slapped at the emergency startup switches. Elegos might have lost track of which ship was which out there, but he hadn't. That shot had come from the flagship of the Ashori Task Force, the war cruiser Predominance. The ship Leia was currently aboard. There was another flash, again heading down toward the Bothoe surface.
You know how to release a docking collar?
Han snapped at Elegos, his hands darting over the control boards.
Yes, I think so.
Do it!
Han cut him off.
Now!
Yes, sir.
Lunging out of his seat, the Kaamasi headed aft. The engines were starting to come up to power now. Han keyed the comm, setting for full frequency scan. It was going to be hell to pay for this one, all right, no matter what the Ashori thought they were doing. The sync numbers for the stabilizer he just installed were coming in now. It seemed to be firming up.
All ships, this is New Republic President Gabrison.
Gabrison's taut voice boomed from the cockpit speaker.
Stand your positions and hold your fire. Repeat, please stand down and hold your fire. The incident currently underway is not...
He never got to finish his plea. Abruptly, there was a squawk of blanketing jamming static on that frequency, drowning him out.
Attack!
A new voice bit out.
All Karelian forces, attack at will!
Han gaped at the speaker. What in blazes was the Karelian doing? And then the scan locked onto another frequency.
Attack!
A guttural Mon Calamari voice rumbled.
All Mon Cal ships, attack! Attack!
A Diamalan voice called calmly in their own language on another frequency.
Attack!
Came the snarling Ashori reply on yet another. Han looked out at the mess of ships, heart thudding in his throat. No. No, this was insane. Surely they wouldn't. But they were. All around the area, the various warships were coming sluggishly to life, heading for the better maneuverability of open sky, or else simply turning their weapons to target their opponents. And even as he watched, the first flashes of turbolaser fire began. Behind him, Elegos charged back into the cockpit.
The colors released,
he announced, breathing heavily as he resumed his seat.
We can leave.
He broke off, staring in disbelief at the scene outside.
What's happened?
He gasped.
Han, what's going on?
It's just what it looks like,
Han said grimly.
The New Republic is at war.
Chapter 37. It was a trip of only perhaps 15 minutes as the Quam Quay flew to the far side of the Hand of Thrawn and the lake Child of Winds had mentioned. At first, Luke had been skeptical of the whole idea, concerned about the young alien's ability to handle the weight of their passengers, not to mention whether or not they would be able to keep out of sight and targeting range of what were surely by now a seriously hostile group of enemies in the fortress. But the Quam Quay had surprised him on both counts. And as they weaved expertly in and out of the cover of trees and rocks and mountain gullies, he almost began to relax about this phase of the operation. Mara, too, he could sense, had already turned her thoughts ahead to what they would find at the end of the short flight. The same, unfortunately, could not be said of R2. Suspended in the center of the framework they'd rigged out of their last lengths of synth rope, he moaned and gurgled the whole way. The cut in the rock was no more than 10 meters from the edge of the lake, descending at a fairly steep angle from under a partial overhang of grass-clumped soil.
At least the rock isn't too rough,
Mara commented, running a hand experimentally along the lower surface. Probably worn down by years of little fire creeper feet running over it. R2 seemed to shudder, warbling uncomfortably.
I doubt we'll run into any more of them this time around,
Luke soothed him as he untangled the synth rope and tucked it back into the droid storage compartment.
Swarms that size can't travel too close together. There won't be enough food for them all.
Let's just hope they're smart enough to know that, Mara added.
You are fortunate. You have come when you did,
Child of Wind said.
There has been much rain in the past few seasons, and the lake of small fish has been growing ever larger.
And have the small fish been getting bigger, too? Mara asked. Child of Winds fluttered his wings.
I do not know. Is it important?
Mara shook her head.
It was a joke. Skip it.
Oh!
Child of Winds looked back at Luke.
I simply meant that soon this entrance may be covered over with water.
I understand, Luke said. But for the moment it's not. And you got us here safely.
It was to our great honor,
Child of Winds said.
What do you wish us to do now?
You've done more than enough already, Luke assured him. Thank you. Thank you all.
Shall we wait for you?
The Quam Kwe persisted.
We would be honored to wait and take you again to your flying machine.
Luke hesitated. A ride back to the ship could be very useful indeed. Unfortunately.
The problem is that I have no idea where we'll be coming out, he said.
Then we will watch,
Child of Wind said firmly.
And others will watch also.
Yes, all right, Luke agreed, anxious to cut off the discussion and get on their way.
Thank you.
So what's our marching order? Mara asked.
I'll go first, Luke said, sitting down on the edge of the slope and putting his legs into the opening. R2 next, you last. I'll watch for bottlenecks and try to widen them as I pass. If I miss one, you'll have to deal with it.
Right, Mara said, pulling her lightsaber from her belt. Happy landings, and try not to cut off your own feet along the way.
Thanks.
Igniting his lightsaber, holding the blade ready over his outstretched legs, Luke eased onto the slope and started down.
It wasn't nearly as bad as he'd feared. Years of little fire creeper feet might indeed have smoothed down the rock. More importantly, they'd also worn away most of whatever obstructions might once have existed there. Only twice did he have to slice out pieces of rock as he slid his bouncy way down. And in one of those cases, it probably hadn't really been necessary. Behind him, he could hear the much louder metallic clattering as R2 slid down the slope, almost but not quite covering up his continual unhappy twittering. The slope emptied into one of the same sort of tunnels they'd spent far too much time in over the past couple of weeks. Luke caught R2 as he fell out, getting him out of the way in time to give Mara a clear landing spot.
Well, here we are again, she said, playing her glow rod around. Doesn't look particularly familiar. Any guesses as to which way?
From the position of the fortress, I'd say that way, Luke said, pointing to the left.
Okay, Mara said. Let's go.
The Quam Kwe, whether by design or simple luck, had chosen their entrance well. They had gone no more than 100 meters along the tunnel when Luke rounded a curve to see an all-too-familiar natural stone archway in the near distance.
We're here, he murmured back toward Mara. Be ready. If they know about the stairway, they'll probably have guards waiting for us inside.
There were no guards.
15 minutes later, having struggled through the narrow gap in the cortosis-laden rock, they were once again standing in the underground room.
I guess they don't know about the stairway after all,
Mara commented, playing her glow rod across the cut they'd made earlier in the yellow inner wall.
Or else don't have any way of getting into it,
Luke reminded her.
Even the locking mechanism on those doors seemed to be made of Hajarna stone.
Don't misunderstand. I'm just as happy to give them a miss this time through,
Mara hastened to say.
I wonder how many of those power conduits are running at the moment.
Probably more than the last time we went through,
Luke said, turning his glow rod to point the other way. As before, the far end of the room was lost in the shadows beyond the light.
I wonder how long this room is.
It can't be too long,
Mara pointed out.
There's a lake somewhere that direction, remember?
Right, Luke agreed. Got any sage advice before we start?
Just that we be careful,
Mara said, joining him.
Side by side as long as we can with the droid behind us. Lightsabers and senses ready.
Succinct and practical,
Luke said, stretching out ahead of them with the Force.
There was no danger yet that he could sense.
Come on, R2.
Mara's point about the room's size turned out to be correct. They had gone only a few steps when the back wall came within range of their glow rods. In the center was an open archway leading farther back into the rock. Not the rough natural rock of the caverns, though. The walls and floor of this passageway were smooth and finished.
Interesting,
Mara said, playing her glow rod around as they stood just outside the archway.
Notice anything peculiar about the ceiling?
It hasn't been smoothed down like the walls have,
Luke said, eyeing the jutting rock hanging down from the arched ceiling.
I wonder,
Mara murmured.
R2, your sensor's getting anything?
R2 warbled a rather distressed-sounding negative, and Luke leaned over to check the datapad translation.
He says the output from the power generator is masking pretty much everything else, he told Mara. That's probably where the hum is coming from, too. You think there's something else up there?
Keeper of Promises said this area was lethal to Quamja,
Mara reminded him.
And we all know how much Quamja like to hang from ceilings.
And we had that cave of predators who eat flying things like Quamja,
Luke nodded, seeing where she was going with this.
And a bunch of Chiss up in the fortress who think of them as vermin.
Not to mention that layer of cortosis ore back there,
Mara said.
Which I still don't believe got there naturally. This place has defense rings 6 ways from Coruscant.
As one would expect, with Thrawn in charge of it, Luke said. Question is, do we try to do something about that ceiling, or assume it isn't something that will bother us?
It's never a good idea to leave a danger at your back,
Mara declared, taking a step just inside the archway.
Here goes.
Igniting her lightsaber, she hurled it expertly up to slice into the rocky ceiling. There was a brilliant flash, the crackle and stench of high energy current, and suddenly the whole ceiling seemed to collapse. Mara was back out of the room in an instant, as Luke ignited his lightsaber and jabbed it protectively over where her head had been. The ceiling fell onto it, draping itself over the green-white blade for a second before it was cut through and fell the rest of the way onto the floor.
How cute, Mara said, peering in over his shoulder. It's like a sculpted Connor net. A Quamja settles to the landing. There's a high-energy discharge that fries him, and the whole thing drops to take out any of his friends who happen to be with him.
That's cute, all right,
Luke murmured, poking at the netting with the tip of his lightsaber.
Question is it safe now for us to walk over?
Probably,
Mara said.
Connor nets are usually single-charge gadgets, and it doesn't do much good to leave it active once it's on the floor.
Makes sense, Luke said, stretching onto the Force as he eased his foot out over the net. No tingling of danger. And sure enough, his foot came down onto the net without even a spark of residual charge.
It's clear, he said.
Hold it! Mara hissed, taking a long step forward and putting her lightsaber handle across his chest to stop him. Her sleeve blaster now gripped in her free hand.
Something's coming.
Luke stopped, listening to the soft clicking of feet on rock. More than one something, too, by the sound of it. He played his glow rod down the tunnel, trying to see what was coming. And abruptly, from a group of narrow side openings he hadn't noticed, came a swarm of fist-sized insect-like creatures scuttling rapidly across the walls toward them.
Watch it!
Mara snapped, her blaster tracking.
No, wait!
Luke said, pushing her arm to the side, off target. He'd caught a glint of metal.
Just keep moving. R2, come on, hurry!
He could sense Mara's strong disapproval, but she did as instructed without argument. The skittering creatures passed them by without slowing, apparently without even so much as a second glance. Luke reached the end of the collapsed Connor net and stepped off onto the stone floor. And as Mara and R2 did likewise, he turned around to look. The creatures had grouped themselves around the front edge of the collapsed net. Even as Luke watched, they began to ease their careful way up the walls, carrying the edge of the net with them. Beside him, Mara snorted gently. Of course, she said, sounding mildly disgusted with herself.
Maintenance droids. There to get the trap reset. Sorry, I guess I overreacted a bit.
Considering it's Thrawn we're dealing with, overreaction isn't likely to be a problem very often, Luke said.
Thanks, but you don't have to try to soothe my feelings,
Mara told him, sliding the sleeve gun away and shifting her lightsaber to her right hand again.
Lesson learned. Shall we go?
What in the Empire are you talking about?
Captain Nalgal demanded, blinking the sleep from his eyes as he grabbed for his uniform and started pulling it on.
How can they be shooting at each other? The flashpoint is still 3 days away.
I don't know, sir,
the Tyrannix duty officer said tautly.
All I know is that the probe ships report the battle has begun, and that the section of planetary shield over the Bothan capital has collapsed. It's hard to tell from this distance, but they say the capital appears to be on fire in several places.
Nalgal swore viciously under his breath. Someone had blundered, and blundered badly. Either the intelligence strike team, or Thrawn himself. It was a shocking thought. A shattering thought, even. If Thrawn's timing could be that far in error... He shook away his misgivings. What was done was done. And whatever mistakes or miscalculations had been made, he was determined that he and the Tyrannic wouldn't add to them.
Have the Obliterator and Iron Hand been informed?
He asked, grunting out the last word as he leaned over to pull on his boots.
Yes, sir. Probe ships report they're coming to full battle stations now.
Make sure we get there ahead of them,
Nalgal told him tartly.
Yes, sir,
the officer said again.
Estimate we'll be at battle readiness in 5 minutes. Probe ships are continuing to feed us reports.
Good,
Nalgal muttered. Now that the shock of the news was fading, he realized it wasn't quite as bad as it had first seemed. All right, so the battle had started early. The 3 Star Destroyers were ready, or would be before their presence was needed to eliminate the survivors of the battle raging out there. And blinded by the cloaking shield as they were, they definitely needed up-to-the-minute reports from the probe ships. The danger was that, with the ships dipping in and out of the shield with that kind of regularity, someone might notice something odd happening around the comet head and come over to investigate. But there was a way to minimize that risk.
Put all tractor beam operators on full alert, he ordered. If any ship besides our own probe ships, and I mean any ship, pokes its nose inside the cloaking shield, I want it grabbed and held inside out of communication. Make sure that message gets to the other ships, too. No one is going to stumble in on us and live to talk about it. Understood?
Understood, sir,
the officer said.
I'll be on the bridge in 2 minutes.
Norgal said, grabbing his tunic and belt.
I want the ship at full battle readiness by the time I get there.
We will be, sir.
Norgal slapped off the intercom and headed out the door of his quarters. Fine. So the aliens and alien lovers couldn't contain their self-destructive hatreds as long as Thrawn had expected. Fine. It just meant that the pent-up boredom and frustration of his crew would get released a little earlier. Smiling grimly, he headed down the corridor toward the turbolift at a carefully measured walk. This was going to be a pleasure. A turbolaser flashed, its lethal red beam sizzling perilously close to the Falcon's starboard side on its way toward an escort frigate with Prosley markings. Han spun the ship away from a second shot, dodged the other direction barely in time to avoid a pair of Bagmim custom ships driving with laser cannon blazing toward the Prosley. The whole universe had gone mad, with him square in the middle of it.
What happened over there?
He called toward the comm, weaving between a pair of Opquist gunships.
According to the Ashori, three humans came aboard about half an hour ago.
Leia's voice came back, the sound of an alert tone droning in the background.
They had New Republic tech IDs and a letter from the Ashori High Conflux authorizing them to examine the Predominance's power couplings for oxidation damage.
Oh, phony, of course.
Han growled, maneuvering the Falcon into a relatively clear space and looking around. It was like Endor all over again out there. Except that this time, the Empire was nowhere to be seen. It was rebels fighting other rebels.
We know that now. Once aboard, they killed their escort and took over one of the turbolaser clusters. When the Drevstarn shield went down, Han, they got 8 shots off onto the surface before we were able to cut off power to their cluster. The Ashori still haven't been able to storm the room and get to them, and even with Barkimk and Sakasak helping them.
Beside Han, Elagos murmured something in the Kaamasi language.
How bad did Drevstarn get hit?
Han asked.
Never mind. That's not important right now. What's happening with you and the ship?
We're under attack,
Leia said, her voice tense.
3 Diamalan ships have joined up against us, one of them sitting between us and the planet in case we try to fire on Drevstarn again. No serious damage yet, I don't think, to either side, but that can't last.
Didn't you tell them what happened?
I told them. The Predominance's captain told them. Gavrasim told them. They're not listening.
Or else don't care,
Han said, clenching his teeth hard enough to hurt. Leia trapped aboard a ship under massive attack.
Look, I'm going to try to get over there,
he told her.
Maybe I can at least get you and Gavrasim off.
No, stay away. Please, you'd never make it.
Han gazed bitterly out at the swirling battle. She was right, of course. From his new vantage point, he could see the Predominance now, and the storm of turbolaser fire raking across it. And he knew full well the Falcon shields wouldn't stand a chance in there. But he couldn't just sit out here and do nothing.
Look, I've outfought Star Destroyers before,
he said.
You've outmaneuvered them,
Leia corrected him.
There's a big difference. Please, Han, don't try to...
There was a squawk, and suddenly she was cut off.
Leia!
Han shouted, his chest tightening as he looked back at the Ashori war cruiser. It still seemed intact, but all it would take would be a single lucky shot into the bridge area.
She's all right,
Elico said, pointing at the comm display.
They are just being jammed again.
Han let out a breath he hadn't realized he'd been holding.
We've got to do something,
he said, searching the sky for inspiration.
We've got to get her off that ship.
The comm crackled back to life.
Leia?
Han called, leaning hopefully toward the speaker.
Solo?
A male voice called.
It's Carib Devist.
Han grimaced.
What do you want? We're kind of busy out here.
No kidding. And whose fault do you think that is?
We already know. Some troublemakers got aboard the Predominance and started shooting. Probably Imperials.
Definitely Imperials.
Carib retorted.
And it was other Imperials who stirred the rest of the crowd into doing likewise. Or didn't you hear them broadcasting recorded attack orders in a half dozen different languages?
Han threw a glower at Elagos, feeling a stab of chagrin at having totally missed reality on that one. So that was what those small Imperial ships Carib had identified had been hanging around Bothawee for. Obvious. Or at least it would have been obvious if anyone out there had bothered to take a minute to think it through. But nobody had.
But that can wait,
Carib went on.
I called to warn you that I think there's something happening out by the head of that comet.
Yeah? What sort of something?
Han asked, his attention already back on the predominance and how in space he was going to get Leia off it.
I don't know. But there are a dozen mining ships fluttering around the area, all of them flying under Imperial pilots.
Han frowned at the comm speaker.
What are you talking about? What would Imperials want with ore buckets?
I tell you, they're Imperial pilots. The whole flying style just screams it out.
Okay, fine,
Han said, not really interested in arguing the point.
So what do you want me to do about it?
There was a hiss of exhaled breath from the speaker.
We're going to check it out,
he said, sounding disgusted.
Under the circumstances, I thought you might be interested in taking a look yourself. Sorry to have bothered you.
The comm clicked off.
I'm sorry, too,
Han muttered. He glanced at Elagos, paused for another look.
What?
He snarled. The Kaamasi lifted his hands, palms up.
I said nothing.
What? You think I should just take off and head out there with him?
Han demanded.
Just leave Leia and go running off on a wild treasure hunt?
Can you help her at the moment?
Elagos countered mildly.
Can you free her or defeat the attacking ships or halt the battle itself?
That's not the point,
Han bit out.
10 to 1, they're just some miners who used to fly for the Empire. There are thousands of them around the New Republic. It doesn't mean a thing.
Perhaps,
Elagos said.
You must balance that against all the rest.
All the rest of what?
The rest of all things, Elagos said. Your knowledge of Carib Devist and his observational abilities. Your belief, or lack of it, that he did not, in fact, betray you to the Empire while you were on Bastion. Your own experience with Imperial procedure and style. And whether you believe someone of Carib's skills could recognize them. Your trust in your wife and her reading of this man.
He lifted his eyebrows slightly.
And most of all, your innate sense of what is right and good. If there is indeed danger of some sort out there, whether you should leave him to face it alone.
He isn't exactly alone,
Han grumbled.
He's got a whole bunch of his other clones with him.
Elagos didn't reply. Han sighed, did a quick search of the sky. There was Carib's beat-up Action 2 freighter, all right, driving out past the boundaries of the battle toward the blazing comet in the distance. All alone.
You know, you Kaamasi could be a real pain if you worked on it a little,
Han told Elagos, turning the Falcon to follow and keying the comm to Lando's comlink frequency.
Lando! Hey, Lando, look alive!
Yeah, Han, what is it?
Lando's tight voice came back.
You back on the Lady Luck yet?
I wish I were,
the other said fervently.
I'm stuck on the Industrious Thoughts with Senator Myotomia.
Han grimaced.
That's one of the ships attacking Leia?
If Leia's on the predominance, yes,
Lando said, his voice both disgusted and more than a little bit nervous.
And we've got to get this thing stopped, and fast.
No argument from me, buddy,
Han said, steering clear of a pair of frothy patrol ships, slugging it out with a Defari and Starbark.
Gaversim's with Leia. If he can get Myotomia to call off their jamming, maybe he can talk this thing down.
I've already tried,
Lando sighed.
I'm the last person aboard anyone's interested in listening to.
I know the feeling, Hunt said. Look, I need a quick favor. I'm heading over to that comet out there with Carib Devist. Put some macro binoculars on me, will you? Just in case we run into trouble.
There was a brief pause.
Sure, no problem. Exactly what sort of trouble are you expecting?
It's probably nothing. Carib seems to think there are Imperials out there flying ore buckets around. Just keep an eye on us, huh?
I will. Good luck.
Han keyed off the comm and swerved around the last handful of ships between him and the comet.
Hang on,
he told Elagos, as he threw full power to the sublight drive.
Here we go.
Easy now,
Belibus warned from Booster's side.
Take it nice and calm and easy. We're all friends here, for the protection of the outer defense perimeter between us and the nasty rebel attack force. You're safe now. There's no need to look like we're hurrying.
No, we wouldn't want to look like that,
Booster growled, staring uneasily at the huge mass of the Ubiquitrate base looming directly ahead of them. Suddenly, his beloved errant venture didn't seem nearly so big and powerful and safe anymore as it used to.
Steady, Tarek,
Belibus said. His voice, to Booster's thorough annoyance, was controlled and glacially calm.
The big show's going on behind us, remember? The last thing we want to do is draw their eyes our direction.
Booster nodded, glancing over at the aft display. There was a show going on back there, all right, with the New Republic ships taking a real beating from the Yaga Minor defense perimeter. Or at least that was how it was supposed to look. If they were following orders, they were actually hanging just far enough back to keep from taking any real serious damage from the mass turbolaser fire. Hopefully, in all the confusion, the Imperials wouldn't notice that.
I don't know, he said. I don't like this, Belibus. We got in much too easy.
General, we've got movement, the officer at the sensor station called. Imperial Star Destroyer, moving up from starboard.
Booster took a few steps forward along the command walkway, peering out the viewport, a bad feeling twisting into his gut. The Star Destroyer had appeared from around the starboard side of the base and had moved across the errant venture's vector. And even as he watched, it stopped there, between them and the base, floating in space in front of them, as if daring them to pass.
The ship IDs is the Relentless, someone else called. Captain Dorja listed as commander.
Booster's bad feeling turned suddenly even worse. The Relentless? Wasn't that the ship that always showed up in the rumors about Grand Admiral Thrawn? Belibus had come up on Booster's side again.
General?
Booster murmured.
I know,
Belibus said, the calmness bending just a bit.
But running now would only make us look guilty. All we can do is play it through.
Transmission from the Relentless, General, the comm officer called. They're asking to speak to Captain Nalgol.
Booster looked at Belibus.
All we can do is play it through,
Belibus repeated.
Go on, give it a try.
Sure.
Taking a deep breath, Booster caught the comm officer's eye and nodded. The man threw a switch and nodded back.
This is Commander Ray Muse, temporarily in command of the Imperial Star Destroyer Tyrannic,
he called, in his best imitation of a typical Imperial's overly stiff speech pattern.
Captain Nalgol was seriously injured in the last attack and is undergoing emergency treatment.
There was a low chuckle from the bridge speakers.
Really?
A calm voice said. A steady voice. A cultured voice. A voice that scared Booster clear down to his boots.
This is Grand Admiral Thrawn.